You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Even as tanks rumble into Baghdad and President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair began the work of dividing up the so-called spoils of war, millions of protesters continue to raise their voices in dissent and put their bodies on the line to stop what they consider to be an unjust and immoral war. Increasingly, police are cracking down harder on anti-war protesters in this country. This morning in Oakland, California, police wearing bulletproof vests fired shotguns using rubber bullets on demonstrators at the Port of Oakland dock. According to the Associated Press, several longshoremen standing by were caught in the line of fire and injured. AP is running a photograph of a woman protester who was severely beaten about the neck and face by Oakland police at the dock, and Reuters is running a picture of a man bearing wounds in his back from the rubber bullets used by police. The protest was staged by members of Direct Action to Stop the War, who want to single out businesses that are profiting from this war. Joshua Clover is a professor at the University of California. He participated in this morning's protest. He spoke with Peace Watch from Port of Oakland Dock, where demonstrators sought to shut down the American President's Line, which ships armaments to Iraq.
We said from the beginning that we want to draw connections between corporations and the war, and our policy has been no business as usual. That was our policy when we shut down the financial zone the day after the war started, and that continues to be our policy. We want to make it clear that we will not accept the possibility or perhaps the reality that this war is not a war of liberation, but a war designed to profit those already powerful in America. And the fact that we believe this is the case suggests to us the extent to which this is an unjust and immoral war.
So you're calling us from the Oakland docks. Are you just standing on the sides, or what are you doing exactly?
There's been a community picket on the docks from 5:30 this morning, and in the community picket, we invited the workers, the longshoremen, who are the ILWU, to join us and to not work and to help shut down the war machine for a day, and they indeed did not cross the picket line and currently are not working, and we have shut down APL for the day. For us, the most important impact is to make it clear the connections we're drawing between corporate profiteers and the war. In the case of APL, which, as I said, is formerly called American President Lines, they were actually listed by AFX Asia, which is a stock advisory for the entire Asian world, to be, and I quote, one of the few corporations that will make a profit from the war in Iraq. What they do is, among other things, they ship armaments to Iraq. They have boats made available to the U.S. government, which the U.S. government uses taxpayer money to fund. So, for example, in 1991 during the Gulf War, their income rose $94 million through their relations with the government, in part money received from the Department of Defense. Our goal is to send a message that we do not accept business as usual, and we're very happy to discover that the longshoremen, the ILWU, are with us in this. They've come out against the war, and in defiance, I should note, of the international ILWU, but our local ILWU has come out clearly against the war, and we want to make it clear that we are not against the workers. We are workers, and we want to be involved with other workers in trying to stop this war.
How much is the American President's Lines likely to earn from shipping arms to Iraq during this second Gulf War, this invasion into Iraq?
Well, I can tell you right now that they receive $100 million in U.S. taxpayer money annually from the Department of Defense. That's actually the parent company of APL, which is called Neptune Orient Lines. And they receive an annual $100 million for making their ships available to the Department of Defense. That includes 9 ships from APL. So that's about 1/5 of Neptune Orient Lines is APL. So that's about $20 million taxpayer dollars annually that go to APL, even in a non-war time. Obviously, in a war situation, it's likely to increase substantially, as evidenced by the fact that their profits rose by $94 million during the very quite brief first Gulf War.
So is this an ongoing protest that you're planning, or just today?
We're targeting different corporations every day and different corporations at different times. We shut down the Bechtel Corporation in San Francisco earlier. It was important for us to target them. We shut down the Carlyle Group, which also profits from the war and is the 11th biggest defense builder in the country. And today we're putting the focus on the Oakland docks and particularly on APL. We do not intend to keep on shutting down this dock every day. We intend to keep the pressure on all corporations that are profiting from the war and make it clear the connection between this unjust and immoral war and the profiteering that goes on by corporations.
Joshua Clover is an English literature professor at the University of California and a member of Direct Action to Stop the War. He spoke with us from the Oakland docks where police fired on protesters using rubber bullets this morning. Meanwhile, across the country, close to 100 people were arrested this morning at the New York offices of the Carlyle Group, a defense contractor and investment firm with close ties to the Bush administration. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with activist Eric Larson.
You're speaking to us from the inside of a police van.
Yes.
How did you end up there?
Well, there were a group of people from M27 Coalition who did a sit-down civil disobedience in front of the Carlyle Group this morning. They arrested them, and then the rest of us were basically standing around to give support, and they just decided to arrest the rest of us, too. We were just standing on the sidewalk doing nothing, and they suddenly decided we were being disorderly in some way, so we got arrested.
Did you resist being arrested?
No, I didn't.
Did you ask why you were being arrested?
I did. It took many, many requests, and I was then told disorderly conduct.
Mm-hmm. Have you been charged with anything yet?
No. We're sitting in a van. We have been for about an hour now.
Mm-hmm. And so are you surprised that you were arrested for simply standing in a crowd the sidewalks of New York City?
Yeah, I was. We were standing in front of the building. We weren't blocking the sidewalk in any way. And the police simply lined up in front of us. But they didn't say anything. Then they told us to disperse. I wasn't coming there to be arrested today. We were chanting and so forth about war profiteers and their crimes. And there was one group that did rush the door to do a civil disobedience to shut the building down, actually shut the building down. They sat down or kneeled down in front of the door, and the rest of us stood around to give support. And then when the rest of us didn't simply go away, they decided to arrest us.
Why are you protesting the Carlyle Group?
Well, the Carlyle Group is really part of what is effectively America's shadow government. It's made up of a whole collection. It's an investment firm made up of a whole collection of highly placed former government officials like George Bush Sr., Frank Carlucci, former defense secretary, and they invest in defense-related companies. They're literally war profiteers, and they make their money by getting their cronies in government to agree to give them contracts to do all manner of things. The Crusader missile, which is one of the big boondoggles of the last few years, was kept alive by Donald Rumsfeld in the sweetheart deal long enough for Carlyle to take the company that produced it public and make about $240 million worth of profits for its partners. So it's Carlyle's a real symbol of the kind of collusion between business and government that makes war profitable for the United States. And that the purpose of our action today really was to expose the Carlyle Group, to shut it down, and to really alert people to the nature of the military-industrial complex that's behind this war. And that's something that we're going to continue to do for a long time now. This war could go on for another 10 years in the Middle East and extend from country to country if the Bush people get their way, and we're going to be fighting at every step.
Is the extent of your protest to show up on the sidewalks there and get arrested, or is there another component to your protest that would actually perhaps have an impact on the Carlyle Group?
This was a fairly legal civil disobedience, legal in the sense that people knew what they were going to get arrested, except in the case of some of us who simply got grabbed. But there's been a lot more direct civil disobedience and direct action as well already. There was a group in California that attempted to occupy Vandenberg Air Force Base. You're going to see a lot more actions like that where we really try to bring the war machine to a halt. And it's going to be creative and it's going to be unexpected. And we think that that's what's really going to get the word out that there's a culture of civil resistance in this country that's not going to let this continue.
Activist Eric Larson arrested outside the New York City headquarters of the Carlyle Group earlier this morning. Over the weekend, hundreds of people flocked to the Indian reservation town of Tuba City, Arizona, to mourn the death of 23-year-old Private Lori Ann Piestewa. She was the first female American soldier to be killed in the war on Iraq and the first Native American. Piestewa was killed with at least 10 others in an Iraqi ambush when her supply convoy, consisting of mechanics, clerks, and cooks, came under fire near the southern Iraqi city of Nazira on March 23rd. She was one of 57 Native Americans currently serving in the U.S. military's so-called Operation Iraqi Freedom and one of 49 who had been deployed to fight in Iraq. Piestewa was a member of the Diné Nation, widely known as Navajo, which has been outspoken on the issue of the war with Iraq. A few weeks ago, the Navajo Nation's president, Joe Shirley Jr., and vice president, Frank Dayish Jr., asked the nation's members to pray for the Native men and women on the front lines and for those who work in homeland security. The official announcement recognizes the rights of Natives to dissent, but it lets them know they will be watched. Furthermore, it shows that the Navajo Nation's government will seek funds from the Homeland Security Office in order to respond to terrorism. The official document says, quote, without infringing on freedom of expression, we will not tolerate behavior or intimidation, and we will closely monitor demonstrations to ensure they do not disrupt the mission of our nation, unquote. Vernon Bellacourt is the Director of International Affairs with the American Indian Movement. In an interview with KPFT's Fernando Velasquez, Bellacourt spoke about Native American relations with the U.S. government.
By a unilateral act of Congress in 1924, they extended citizenship to the original natural people of this land called the American Indian. Previous to that, of course, we were not considered citizens of the United States. We have to ask the question, what right that we don't already have by virtue of our birth as members of sovereign Indian nations, what other rights do we get by being American citizens? And if you answer that question, you would find that, one, we have to pay taxes, and two, we have to serve in their military. Now, first of all, in First World War, more than 60,000 primarily American Indian men of many nations, including my father, who was one of the highest decorated Marines coming out of the First World War. So no one can question the patriotism of the Indian people. However, I feel that that patriotism is misplaced in the United States government, which first waged a genocidal war against our people that claimed perhaps as many as 16 million, starting with the biological weapons of smallpox from Valley Forge up in Amherst, Massachusetts. Of course, Lord Jeffrey Amherst, of which a city and a prestigious university is named after, started the biological war against Indian people that claimed perhaps as many as 8 million of us across the country. So one would have to ask the question, why is it that our people still enlist in the military in such large, disproportionate numbers? Well, in reality, most of our men and women go into the military to escape the poverty of reservation life. They go in order to get an education and get training. And however, they're told, of course, that be all you can be. What they don't tell these young people is you could be dead also, such as the young Hopi women who lost their lives in the conflict in Iraq. I would like to say to my Indian people, this is not our war. This is George Bush and the oil company's war. It's an illegal act. And our people should not serve in the military in Iraq, committing a genocide for the United States. The United States is an international outlaw, along with Great Britain. They're in violation of international law and laws against humanity. And I want to say to our people and to the Hopi family who lost their daughter that they should consider filing a breach of against the United States government, to try to recover damages, which they can never recover for the loss of their loved one. But the reality is, this is not our war, and I don't know why our people insist on sending their children into the military. Historically, Adolf Hitler was not elected by the people, yet he waged the war of genocide across Europe, and they called it the Third Reich. Today we see the emergence of the Fourth Reich with the Bush administration that, first of all, bushwhacked democracy, bushwhacked our right to have our votes count. He's an unelected president of the United States, and like Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, he and his administration are waging the same kind of genocidal war against the people of Iraq. And so what we have to do today is we have to put our spirits together and our bodies together to bring to a halt this international criminals in the form of the Bush administration who is waging war on the Iraqi people. We can best describe Homeland Security as the Nazi Gestapo or the brown shirts that violated the rights of all German citizens. And we are on the verge of the same type of repression here in what is called the United States. So Americans should wake up and realize what is going on here with this so-called Homeland Security. Obviously, there's a gross breach of contract here when we see our young women dying on the battlefields of Iraq for a war that is not ours.
Vernon Belcourt, Director of International Affairs with the American Indian Movement, he spoke with KPFX's Fernando Velasquez. As the war in Iraq continues to grab headlines, another war is taking place much closer to home. Dr. Ron Daniels, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, spoke recently with Peace Watch about the war against civil liberties.
The whole notion that if we can keep the American people in a sense of permanent crisis, the war against terrorism, because they're coming, you know, it's the orange alert, it's the whatever alert it is, there's always this sense of something is about to happen. Then second, the question against the war against Iraq, and if one sees how that's unfolding, there's less and less being said about weapons of mass destruction and less being said about chemical and biological weapons, and more about the demonization of Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi regime. Now, obviously, most of us are not trying to say that Saddam Hussein was an angel or Saddam Hussein had some democratic regime, but we all know that this has never been the criteria by which the United States has judged its relationships with various people. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, it angers me when Tony Blair or Bush talk about how brutally Saddam Hussein treats his people, and there are no doubt instances of gross human rights violations. But I mean, where were their voices when Gramajo and others were presiding over in various regimes that the United States had a relationship with when 200,000, you know, I mean, peasants, you know, mostly indigenous people were basically liquidated. You know, the United States overthrows, is in complicity with the overthrow of Salvador Allende, puts in Pinochet. I mean, what about his record? I mean, how did he treat the, you know, the people being disappeared and whatever? So I think we're all clear about that. But I think these are the kind of points, it seems to me, that we're going to have to make in a broader circle of people. I mean, and that's being done. One of my favorite sort of notions about how we expand the base is through hypocrisy and contradiction. That people really have got to understand how dangerous the moment is. And I think one of the problems is, in terms of the sort of ethnic and religious profiling of this matter, is that it's those people over there somewhere. Mm-hmm. But Nancy Chang documents in her book that it ain't just the people over there. There's the case of a student who wasn't a protester, who had an unflattering picture of George Bush on the wall. The FBI came knocking. Or an elderly gentleman who was at a health spa or one of these fitness centers and, you know, was making some remarks in relationship to Bush, and he got visited by the FBI. You know, because in a minute it will be everybody, because the notion, again, is to keep everyone in a sense of permanent crisis. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I think I want to raise in this regard, in terms of this movement, and certainly our friend here raised this question, that it's not just the war against terrorism, which is flawed and ill-conceived, and I don't have time to go into all that, and obviously the war itself. But the tremendous diversion that's involved here, while resources are being diverted, and certainly I think this is being picked up in the African-American community. And one of the things that I would urge, and this is being talked about all across the country, is a strong resistance coming from the African-American community, at least in terms of what the polls say. That is not as visible as one might want it to be. But I know here locally they're making strides to organize. All across this country, African-American organizers are picking up the pace in terms of organizing the African-American community to play a more leading role in the struggle. And I would hope as that happens that there's certainly, you know, space opened up within the peace movement for that to take place. I got some reports today about some of the things that may have happened here today that were somewhat disquieting in that regard. So, I mean, that's one of the things we have to look for. The question is, you know, healthcare, the whole question of the rebuilding of the cities, the whole question of poverty in this society that's on the increase, declining incomes, even for the middle class. I mean, all of these things are taking place even as our eyes are focused away from quality of life issues and certainly the rollback of affirmative action, the rollback of environmental protection laws. All of these things are being rolled back. And I guess my final point is to say that because this is a part of a context, it is a broader context. And that context really is a broad-ranging struggle between the forces that have always fought over the nature of American society. Those who've always wanted to constrict American democracy and make it democracies for the few, yeah, versus those of us who've always seen it as a more expansive democracy. And that's one of the reasons why we really, really do have to fight hard for the immigrant populations that are coming into this society. Because that is the expansive view of history that we want to deal with. But as we do that, we have to also find respectful ways of also educating and radicalizing even some of those populations. It is of concern to me that our Latino brothers and sisters in the poll are 67% in favor of this war. And so we have to begin to, again, in very respectful ways, begin to raise questions about, I mean, if you're from Puerto Rico, I mean, you fled Puerto Rico to come here primarily because of the neocolonial or colonial status of Puerto Rico and issues like Vieques and how Puerto Rico is being treated. You know, we have to begin to get that kind of consciousness going. I mean, people are fleeing countries to come to this country because of the oppression or complicity of this oligarchy with their oligarchy and the repressive regimes, and they come here and raise the flag in support of the very regimes that are oppressing their countries that forced them to come here in the first place. So we have to be engaged in a broad-ranging public education effort that really, in very popular language, reaches out to the churches. We received a very disturbing figure today from somebody, I don't know who it was, Michael, who said that about 60-70% of labor, of union membership supports the war. But this is the very working class that we see as being the vanguard of the revolution. So that means we've got a lot of work to do, you know, in getting at Joe Sixpack, you know, coming to understand and unpacking. And as I said last night, and this is sort of my final point, I believe that there are probably a hardcore people in this country who are so infected with patriarchy, with homophobia, with sexism and racism, and this whole testosterone focus about America being number one, that we would never change their minds. I don't believe that, however, that's the majority. I think there is a significant margin of people who can be persuaded.
Dr. Ron Daniels, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking recently in Boston, Massachusetts. Special thanks to David Goodman for preparing that piece. A U.S. peace activist volunteering as a human shield on the West Bank of the Jordan River was seriously wounded over the weekend when Israeli troops reportedly opened fire on him. Brian Avery, 24, from Albuquerque, New Mexico, heard shots fired and came out of his apartment building in Jenin to investigate just as an Israeli armored personnel carrier rounded a corner, according to Tobias Carlson, a fellow activist from Sweden. Avery and Carlson are members of the International Solidarity Movement, which uses nonviolent methods to protest against Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. Members of the group often insert themselves between Palestinian and Israeli soldiers to try and stop Israeli military operations. Quote, "We had our hands up and we were wearing vests that clearly identified us as international workers when they began firing,"
Carlson said. Brian was shot in the face, and it looks like he was hit by a heavy caliber bullet because of the extent of the wound. Avery was taken to Jenin Hospital, Carlson said. Avery was semi-conscious when taken in the ambulance. The Army said homemade firebombs were reportedly being thrown at troops, and it returned fire at gunmen in the area, although it was not aware of hitting anyone. An eyewitness to the account reported this morning on Democracy Now! That the Army's account is an outright lie. Avery had written home saying he wanted to carry on the work of Rachel Corrie, another American member of that group who was killed March 16th while trying to stop an Israeli military bulldozer in the Gaza Strip. Corrie courageously sat in front of the machine, which ran over her and then backed up. Israeli officials said the incident was an accident and the bulldozer driver didn't see her. The Army says the driver is back on the job today. Avery had just written about Rachel Corrie, letting people know back home what happened and that people were standing in her name and continuing her work.
In a land far away from this silent sheltered place, there my brother and my sister have no dignity or space as they live in fear with the terror nearer than their face. It's a disgrace. And then comes Rachel Corrie and some others of her kind. From the land of privilege, they bravely cross the line to protect the lives of sweet Palestine's forgotten blood. Angels of love. And I wonder, could I be so brave? Will my words and deeds reflect this flag that I wave? Will my conscience guide like this angel of love, Rachel Corrie? Well, we didn't mean to kill her. She was just in our way. These people have to learn it's our world and they can't stay. We'll kill another dozen by the end of the day. And the IDF will not be swayed by some peacenik chick who gets in our way. Rachel Corrie. And the heavens have opened for us now, and the angels of love have come to show us how. Let our consciences guide, we will never die or live in vain. Love is the way.
Angels of Love, an anonymous work dedicated to the Palestinian people. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Pete Karakas, Jay Winter Nightwolf, Sidrak Franklin, and Keith Shaljian. Thanks to Pete Karakas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.